It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A panel of advisors to the Food and Drug Administration finds the main ingredient in some popular cold medicines is ineffective. What will relieve symptoms like congestion and stuffy nose? WebMD lists over-the-counter medications like Sudafed, PE, DayQuil, and Tylenol Sinus. They all contain phenylephrine. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Feldman is a pharmacist and toxicologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me back on.
Good morning. Are you surprised by the FDA's committee's recent findings on phenylephrine?
I actually am not. And I think those who work in the pharmacy field might not be surprised either. This isn't actually the first time that the efficacy of phenylephrine has been challenged. It's simply the first time that it was ruled or voted on that it is likely that phenylephrine was ineffective. In 2007, a group of pharmacy researchers from the University of Florida actually petitioned the FDA to analyze phenylephrine's efficacy. And at that time, it was determined more research was needed and that phenylephrine might work, but it still wasn't, you know, a very positive review. And then in 2015, another petition was made to reanalyze the data after more data had come out. And that kind of brought us to today, where the panel has met again. And after looking at the data, has found it actually doesn't seem to be better than placebo for the indication of acute nasal congestion.
What is it supposed to do? What exactly is this drug?
So phenylephrine is actually a very useful drug in operating rooms and emergency departments where we use it intravenously to squeeze the blood vessels and raise people's blood pressure. The idea for nasal congestion was that you could take it orally and it would constrict the blood vessels in the nose. And if that big inflamed blood vessels were blocking air passage in the nose, if you constrict them, then air will move more freely through the nose. So it'll relieve the nasal congestion that way. Unfortunately, when you take it orally, a very large amount of it does not get into the bloodstream. So there's a question as to whether it really has any effect at all, because so much of it gets metabolized before it gets in, into your body.
So the Food and Drug Administration panel, they were testing the oral application of this drug. What does it mean for nasal decongestants?
That's a really, so oral administration is the really important thing to talk about here, because there actually are a number of intranasal versions of phenylephrine.
Mm-hmm.
And those, the efficacy is not being questioned because you can get high enough concentrations there. It's actually sort of an interesting story with nasal decongestions. There were three oral nasal decongestants on the market. One of them was actually removed. It was called phenylpropanolamine, and that was after the FDA reviewed safety data, and they found that phenylpropanolamine was actually causing a number of head bleeds, which obviously is not something that we want to happen when you're taking an over-the-counter medicine. So the FDA looked at the safety data for that nasal decongestant and determined that the risk was too high, and they removed that one from the market. Now that left us with two nasal decongestants. You had pseudoephedrine and phenylephrine. Pseudoephedrine in 2005 was put behind the counter, meaning you had to go to a pharmacy and usually you have to present them with a form of identification and you buy it from behind the pharmacy counter. And that was because pseudoephedrine has been used in the production of illicit substances. If anybody's watched Breaking Bad, they might be aware of that. So that kind of left us with the only readily available nasal decongestant, oral nasal decongestant that you could buy right off a shelf, was phenylephrine. But it doesn't mean that it's the only nasal decongestant available. There's many other types, like nasal sprays, there's antihistamine nasal sprays, there are steroid nasal sprays, saline nasal sprays. All of these can help with nasal congestion depending on what the source is. And then there's also antihistamine oral tablets, which can help dry up mucus secretions that lead to nasal congestion. So there are actually quite a few therapeutic options still available, including an oral nasal decongestant that will shrink the blood vessels called pseudoephedrine that simply needs to be bought behind the pharmacy counter.
Ryan Feldman with us, pharmacist and toxicologist with the Medical College of Wisconsin, as we look at decongestants and the recent news on phenylephrine. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Ryan, with this committee decision from the FDA, should people throw away medication containing phenylephrine? What is the guidance there?
Well, let's talk about what this is going to mean in the future. Right now, the Non-Prescription Drug Advisory Council, or committee, voted that phenylephrine does not appear to be effective based on the evidence. But that's not the final ruling. The FDA still needs to consider this advisory committee's ruling and take public opinion. So there will be a time for public comment. And after considering both public comment and the advisory committee's rulings, then they would have to give a final ruling as to whether or not phenylephrine is considered what we call generally recognized as safe and effective. So nothing has happened yet. Phenylephrine is still on the shelves. People can still take it, but it's just likely that it's not going to have a very significant effect. If the FDA does rule that it is not a generally recognized as safe and effective drug, then they'll be working with manufacturers to remove phenylephrine from their products. But it's not necessarily going to be a strip all the pharmacy shelves of phenylephrine as soon as possible. There were certainly no concerns regarding its safety. So the downside, there's not necessarily a downside beyond the fact that the drug simply won't work based off the available evidence for what we're trying to treat, which is nasal decongestion.
And the FDA issued a statement Thursday basically clarifying the panel's results and saying just that neither the FDA nor the committee raised safety concerns. And, meanwhile, the FDA says decongestants are a $1 billion sales market. Could the new results affect how the agency reviews safety and efficacy of drugs?
Well, I think this is actually an interesting story. I think a lot of people probably have the question of how was phenylephrine on the market without actually having efficacy data to support it? And in 1962, this is going to be really entertaining, I'm sure. One thing more boring than law is pharmacy law, but we're going to
No
dive in
caveats
just.
here,
But,
please.
well, so in 1962, in response to an outbreak of very serious medication reactions, there was the Kefauver-Harris Act was put into place, which required drugs, when they were brought into market, to prove that they were not just safe, but also effective in the conditions that they wanted to treat. So until 1962, you could bring a drug to market as long as you showed that it wasn't going to harm people. But you didn't have to prove that it worked. Phenylephrine was brought to market before 1962. So it was sort of grandfathered in, as they say. And then 10 years later, in 1972, the FDA, realizing they had all of these drugs that had come in before they were required to prove actual efficacy, they created a process called the OTC drug monograph, where an advisory council would review the drugs and determine, well, based off the small available data that we do have, is this probably effective? So a ton of the older drugs sort of got labeled as generally regarded as safe and effective, even though there wasn't a ton of efficacy data, simply because they had been around for a long time. Phenylephrine was put into this classification in 1994 as generally regarded as safe and effective, and that meant it was allowed to be sold on pharmacy counters. But this classification can be challenged at any time, and really by anyone. So there was a citizen's petition in 2007 regarding phenylephrine's efficacy, and that led to that first review of its efficacy data, and which led to the call for more research. And then we had more research, and now with the more research showing no real benefit, there's a strong consideration as to whether it should get this classification. So this is actually a really interesting demonstration of regulatory bodies that are supposed to keep our drugs safe and effective actually considering removing drugs when they're not proven to be safe. And I think that's actually a great demonstration of the body doing what it should be doing.
Pharmacist Ryan Feldman at Medical College of Wisconsin helping us understand the history of phenylephrine, helping us to understand how decongestants work, used to relieve symptoms associated with cold allergies. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts to the conversation. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An advisory committee to the Food and Drug Administration concludes a common ingredient found in a number of cold medicines is ineffective. The FDA's review finds 242 million packages or bottles of phenylephrine products were sold last year. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your concerns. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Medical College of Wisconsin pharmacist and toxicologist Ryan Feldman here. Ryan, the FDA says, as we've been talking about, phenylephrine ineffective, the committee says, but the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, which is the trade group representing manufacturers of over-the-counter medicines, they say phenylephrine is effective. So what about the conflicting guidance here?
Right. Well, effectiveness all depends on what you're measuring as effective. So I think we do have to recognize the Consumer Health Product Association is funded almost entirely by the drug companies that are, it is a trade group, right? And it's the drug companies that sell phenylephrine. So, of course, they are far more likely to find research that benefits phenylephrine than not, as opposed to independent researchers who assess things more objectively. I do know the Consumer Health Product Association did their own analysis of data, which was presented to the FDA at some of these petitions, and it was came up to different conclusions from the pharmacist researchers who initially petitioned the FDA, and both were considered, but we still have this result that has occurred. So you can sometimes make statistics look however you want, I've been told. And I'm not saying that that is necessarily what has happened, but it is possible to look at two different, to look at the same thing and come to two different conclusions based off of the results that you're looking at. I know, for example, the Consumer Health Product Association, they looked at nasal decongestion within 1 hour versus the citizen researchers who petitioned looked at nasal decongestion within 4 hours. So if you look at different outcomes, you might come to different conclusions. So there is, though, some smaller, potentially weaker data that was identified in the original petition in 2007 that showed there might be some weak effect of phenylephrine. It just hasn't panned out in many of the larger studies that were done afterwards.
I was going to just jump in here. If you could kind of bring us to a better understanding of the power of the placebo effect, because the FDA's decision stemming from that petition you mentioned by University of Florida researchers that products, phenylephrine failed to outperform placebo pills. Is a placebo pill would be something like a sugar pill without medication?
That's exactly what it is. It's something to make you believe that you're taking medication. And in fact, the placebo effect is very real. If you give somebody a sugar pill and tell them it's a medicine, depending on what you're telling them you're treating, about 30% or so might actually feel a treatment effect from it. So it's a way that we test whether or not a drug is actually having an effect. Because if it does what we think it should, you should be able to reliably reproduce the effect in the body over multiple observations in multiple different populations. And it should be more pronounced than the placebo tablet. And unfortunately, we did not see that in the specific tests that were done with phenylephrine.
Ryan Feldman with us, pharmacist and toxicologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Let's bring in Mark in Wauwatosa. Mark, hi.
Hi. Yeah, a couple of remedies that I've been using. Probably heard about them on WPR a long time ago. I don't know. One of them is uncrystallized ginger. I just buy it at the store in a bag, and I don't know, it's like dried sugared ginger. They put some kind of icky coating on it to preserve it. I just kind of wash that off, and it works. And then I also can occasionally use a Ball Blue Book recipe for Fiesta Salsa, and I get this hot pepper juice and left over. And what am I going to do with that? Well, I can that, and that becomes my cold tonic. So, you know, it's just, it works.
Mark, thank you. Using home remedies, salsa and ginger, Ryan.
Well, you know, I think everybody has had a very spicy salsa before and realized that it has cleared their sinuses a little bit. Sometimes they get a little bit of a runny nose from that as well. There are many different remedies out there. Home remedies have been around for, you know, we've only had modern medicine for roughly 100 years. So before that, we were using all sorts of herbal supplements. You know, anything that you're using, I do, of course, encourage you to run it by your doctor or your pharmacist who has a full list of your medication and can make sure that there's no interactions or anything funny that's going to go on with what you're using.
Let's bring in Wendy in Oconomowoc. Wendy, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a registered nurse. And well, I was. I'm retired. And I had always taken pseudoephedrine for colds in the past, and it always worked well for me. When they took it off the market, I decided that I was going to try these other preparations. I did not think they worked for me. So when they actually did bring it back, I always do now go to the pharmacist and sign for the pseudo. Now, I'm wondering if people who felt that they had an effect from it were taking preparations that also contained other ingredients, and they were actually noticing some effects from those, like the acetaminophen made them feel a little better or something.
Oh, Wendy, thank you. Yes, great question. Ryan?
Yeah, so you bring up two good points. Number one, pseudoephedrine does have good efficacy data, and part of the whole FDA petition, they presented that pseudoephedrine does reliably reduce nasal congestion as compared to phenylephrine. The other thing is that phenylephrine is in a number of combination products. So people might have a product out there that contains acetaminophen or ibuprofen and phenylephrine. And if you do have that at home, you shouldn't be worried that the phenylephrine is decreasing the efficacy of the other drugs in there. So it is okay to still take that medicine. And of course, either the drug that's in that, the other drugs that are in there could provide symptomatic relief, and some might be assigning that to phenylephrine. Or potentially there is a placebo effect, so to speak, where anyone who thinks they're taking any drug of any type to treat their condition, you might actually feel, whether it's a drug or not, you might feel a reduction in symptoms. So all of those things can happen. It's a great point to bring up.
What might happen to the use of pseudoephedrine? I mean, would that get more use in terms of what the FDA does going forward with phenylephrine?
So pseudoephedrine is going, if phenylephrine is removed from the market, if that does occur, which it has not been, anything final has been made, pseudoephedrine would be the last oral decongestant that's available. But there are many other types of symptomatic relief people can get from pharmaceuticals. And I think we'll just have to focus on educating consumers on what things are available, like antihistamines. You know, if somebody has a lot of congestion from nasal drip, as they call it, or mucus production, antihistamines can be helpful there. You can use topical substances that will constrict the blood vessels. There are nasal steroids. There's really quite a few. So if somebody needs an oral for acute symptomatic relief, pseudoephedrine will probably be the last option if phenylephrine gets removed. But it doesn't mean that there aren't a number of other readily effective agents.
As a pharmacist, are you getting questions about this?
Well, this is relatively recent news. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with the changing of the weather, people deal with congestion all the time, and it really can be disabling for some people and cause a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. But we have plenty of options out there. So if anybody is concerned, I really encourage you to reach out to your local pharmacist or your primary care provider, because there's likely still many options available that can help you.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on today.
Ryan Feldman is a pharmacist and toxicologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we take walks in the fall leaves and admire the magnificent color around us, it's nice to be able to identify different tree species in Wisconsin. Their leaves give us clues, and we explore your thoughts on leaves. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brad Hutnick is a forest silviculturist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, working statewide on maintaining high-quality forests. Brad, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here.
Well, Wisconsin trees starting to change color. Where are you seeing leaves changing?
Well, here in Wisconsin, we'll see our trees start to senesce or turn color in the north and then come to the south. And so right now, you can see colors about halfway through the state. If you're down to, say, the central part of the central sands, coming a little further south, especially when you come over to the Driftless, you'll start to see the beginning of it, although some places, depending upon the conditions we have, may be ahead of others this time of the year.
Yes, I noticed on the fall color report by Travel Wisconsin that the St. Croix Valley area seems to be a little more advanced. Is that pretty typical?
Well, every year we see differences around the state, and it's really because there are lots of things changing. And so one of them will be weather, right? So the weather in one part of Wisconsin, even places that are fairly similar, two counties apart or one county apart, you'll see these differences in the amount of water they've received or just other conditions that can have an influence on the fall colors.
On the fall colors, why can leaves change specifically to colors like yellow and red and orange?
Yeah. So leaves, and it kind of gets into the, you know, kind of the science behind photosynthesis, but essentially they're working with a lot of different chemicals and pigments within the leaves. And so with our broadleaf deciduous trees, we have the chlorophyll, that's the green part that we see throughout the growing season. And then you have the anthocyanins, which are kind of the red colors, and the carotenids, which are the yellows and oranges and things of that nature. And they're all present in the leaf throughout the year, some of them kind of maybe peaking even toward fall. But in the fall, as the days get shorter, our nights get shorter, the leaves and the trees kind of get a signal to say, hey, it's time to shut down. Get rid of these leaves because they're going to be a liability for winter. And so as they shut down, that the chlorophyll will basically dissipate. And as that happens, then it reveals the rest of the colors that were present in that leaf. And so it basically it's and then depending upon the color, the conditions in the previous year, it can affect the how we perceive those colors as well.
What happens in evergreens then?
So the evergreens are basically they're holding their leaves throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
They may be shutting down. So as a good example, they don't want to stay open for business during the winter, because if they're letting we can see things like this, but if they're giving off water during the winter, they can actually dry out and they can actually become we'll call it winter burned. And so they're trying to hold on to that water. They're shutting down as much as they can as well, but they're not dropping their needles unless you're something like a tamarack, and they'll drop their needles, but they'll regrow them in the spring.
Are the leaves of a tree, are they the best way to identify one tree from another? Because the tree has other clues as well.
Yeah, and so it is kind of, that's the fun part about this time of the year, is that you have lots of different ways to identify trees. Hmm. So you can identify trees any season. You could be going 65 miles or faster down the road past the woods, and you can identify trees just by certain characteristics that they'll have. Leaves are really good, but we would probably start with something like the branching on the tree. So if you were standing underneath a broadleaf, say a deciduous tree, and you could see the branches on that tree, if they're going to, you can kind of tell lots of things by the branching structure that you see.
As we talk about the science of leaves and how to identify a tree by its leaves, we go to Brad Hutnick, who's with us, a forest silviculturist for the Wisconsin DNR. And you can join in with your questions about trees at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So Wisconsin being home to many types of leaf-producing trees, what types of leaves are the most common here in Wisconsin?
Sure. So we basically, we have two types of leaves on our deciduous trees, essentially. We have simple leaves, which are basically one big leaf, right? Or you have compound leaves, which are basically one leaf, but it has small leaflets attached to it. So as a good example, like we always hear people say, leaves of three, let it be, right? When you're talking about poison ivy, and it's not a tree. But those would be leaflets, not actually leaves. And so with a tree, if we think of something like hickories or locusts or maybe even our ashes, they have leaflets, but they have and compound leaves.
Okay. And so that is a really important distinction there. But what about like the tree might drop a fruit or like nuts and acorns or cones. How might that affect your identification?
Sure. So there are lots of ways to identify trees. If you're a forester and you're walking through the woods, you can do it by the bark. You can tell by the color of the bark, by the texture of the bark, by lots of different things. I mentioned the structure of the branches. Some trees, we know that basically we have opposite branching trees here in Wisconsin and alternate branching trees. And we have maybe one species that actually has a whirled branches around it, our catalpas that we do see occasionally. But there are lots of other things. So you mentioned the leaves are one. We can look at the buds, look at the size and the color and the texture of those. And we can look at the fruit, right? So if we're seeing acorns or if we're seeing samaras, which are basically the leaves that are falling from maples, those will all give us clues about the particular species we're looking at. And sometimes it's even where it's growing. If it's a native tree growing in a natural setting, if you're in a wet area versus a dry area, that gives you a lot of clues as to what that tree would be.
So as we look at the branching, we're looking up. And so as you look at the crown of the tree, what would you notice there?
Sure. So if I were looking into the crown, you would look at the individual branch or like the main branches coming off of the trunk. And then you would look for the branches that come off the opposite branches. The branches would come off each side of that main branch coming off of the trunk. Versus the alternate, it could be a little more of a herringbone pattern. And the classic for that here in Wisconsin would be elms. So elms, if you look at them would have that herringbone pattern to them. But even the crowns themselves can have a different structure or shape. You know, people wax romantically about the days back in the 60s, 50s, prior to Dutch elm disease, when we had streets lined by elm trees, and they had a more of a vase shape to them. They grew up and kind of created these like almost like a vaulted cathedral effect over a street, which was really striking. And when those were gone, then we do still have some trees that do that, but not to the degree they did. And so each of the trees will have their own gestalt, right? They'll have their own kind of like when you see them, you know, oh, that's what it is.
I grew up on a street with that elm canopy, and I remember it so well because, as you said, it just created almost like this dome over your street. You know, so also the type of leaf, whether it's like smooth or it has those little teeth on the edge of the leaves, that can also, yep, I would imagine, give clues.
Yep. So we'll have you can have a serrated edge to a leaf, or you can have a plain or a smooth edge to the leaf. And you're right, that'll tell us a lot about about what we see as one of those clues that we have. But you know, there are tons of other clues. I mean, I was just I'm always struck. We used to have, when I was a kid, we had a ginkgo down the street. And ginkgos are really beautiful. They're not native to Wisconsin. They're urban trees. They have a beautiful yellow flower in the fall, or I'm sorry, yellow leaf in the fall. But when the fruit come down, you know it, because they really stink. And so it was really distinctive. You did not want to step on or be associated with that tree when the fruit were on the ground.
What does a leaf say about the health of a tree?
So that's really interesting, because We and our forest health staff with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will be looking at that a lot. So they'll be looking at, how are those leaves responding during the year? Are they noticing anything that's kind of maybe diseases that are starting to show up? Are they noticing early senescence, late senescence? Are they noticing a lot of things? And that could tell you a lot about the general health of those trees. Oftentimes, if you're driving through southwestern Wisconsin during the summer, you can look up on the hillsides and you'll see individual trees that are yellow, which is kind of striking, but usually it's a white oak that's sitting probably fairly close to some limestone, and it's not healthy. And so that's one of the things you can notice. You can see trees at oftentimes other times of the year that will show you that that there's something not quite right.
If a tree is unable to produce a significant amount of leaves, is that an indicator, or is something just to watch? Does that mean it's unhealthy?
Yeah, there's something going on with it. And so if you have trees that are maybe only partly leafed out during the year, or maybe they have very small leaves, or they have shriveled leaves, or they have eaten leaves, that tells you a lot about what's happening with it. Now, you may not know exactly what's happening, but that's where we can... forest health pathologist, other people can start to dig into that. Even just the foresters that you know in your area, your local DNR forester, other people can tell you a lot about what they're seeing in your county and what might be happening in your situation.
I know I've been watching these little brown spots on leaves, and what that could mean, whether it's harmless or something to be concerned about. That's something you also see.
Yeah, you know, I think it was Leopold said something in the effect of, he had as many diseases in his forest as he had trees. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it is a disturbance. And as a natural disturbance, if it's not an introduced disease or things of that nature, it's actually contributing to the health, overall health of the forest, even though on the short term, it doesn't look good.
Brad Hutnick, forest silviculturist at the State DNR, call in about leaves, what you wonder. The number to join in the conversation with your question, your thoughts, at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. All trees have clues and features in their leaves that can help with identification. We just need to know what to look for, and we get help from the DNR. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts on leaves. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have forest silviculturist Brad Hutnick with us as our guide. Brad, we heard from Jerry in Verona, who is reacting to the ginkgo tree, and mentioning, you know, only the female tree smell is off-putting, has the off-putting smell, and also the ginkgo tree is prehistoric. Some follow-up there.
Yeah, that is correct. So actually, the ginkgo tree is native to China. It isn't found in the wild anymore. So basically, it was a kind of a temple tree, things of that nature. It was, and basically people admired it, and over time people moved it around the world. And he's 100% correct. It's only the females when they're producing those seeds. The problem is, I think a lot of times with when we're planting nursery stock in urban settings, is that it's really hard to tell when the trees are young whether they're males or females. So we'll try to use, and we're getting better and better at identifying that, but you still find trees now and then. So this would have been when I was younger. That was quite some time ago. So, you know, maybe the ways to assess whether a ginkgo is male or female before planting have gotten a lot better since then.
The DNR recommends using the LeafSnap app to identify trees by their leaves. And so you take a picture of a leaf with your smartphone. And we have a link, by the way, to the app at WPR.org/mornings. What leaf features does LeafSnap consider?
So it'll take a look at a lot of different things. It'll look at, like you mentioned before, whether the margin of that leaf is entire, right? So it's basically smooth, or it's serrated. It'll look at whether that leaf is lobed. So it's got, think of a maple leaf would have those three big lobes along the top of it. So it'll look at, are there lobes present, or is it just one big, like a round or oblong kind of leaf? It'll look at the features like we talked about before, whether it's a compound leaf. And if it's a compound leaf, how narrow are those, are the leaflets? How many leaflets are there? You can't really see so much, but maybe like how big is the leaf? Things of that nature. It's really, really good.
How accurate is LeafSnap?
You know, I've used it, and I haven't used it a lot because I'm, you know, kind of trained on leaves and things like that. But I haven't actually found any situations where it's been inaccurate for my use.
Okay, so that could be handy for people who aren't walking in your shoes as a silviculturist. Let's bring in Rich in Egg Harbor now. Rich, what's on your mind?
I have a question about taking cuttings from like a nut tree, hickory or oak or whatever, and if I could, how to clone it to start my own tree.
Yep. So that's a really good question. So a lot of trees you can basically, and you can look it up online, because I'm not an expert on how to say on doing cuttings of trees. Our nursery staff would be fantastic for something like that. But I know there are certain species that will actually naturally, so think of cottonwoods, willows, things of that nature. You probably don't even have to do much, but stick that stick in the ground and it will root and take off and become a new tree. Others need to be encouraged, so you can use some rooting hormones. And so really, I in that situation, I would consult with an arborist or an urban forester, or maybe someone associated with the nursery trade. They might have a really good answer for that.
Rich, thank you so much for calling in. Looking at the conditions through the summer, Wisconsin experiencing drought conditions. The Associated Press reporting drought causes leaves to brown and wither before they can reach peak color. Are drought conditions stressing trees this year?
Yeah, so it is a stress, right? And so we have lots of different stresses that our trees will go through. But this year, I think we can identify, you know, that lack of water during different times of the year could be a problem. And as you identified, it can accelerate the natural aging process of leaves, which would cause them to senesce or age prematurely. But on the flip side, what it can do is maybe give us a longer, it can give us a longer season as well, because as we mentioned before, not every place is going to be, so think about a landscape, there will be wetter and drier parts of that landscape. And so if you had a consistently wet area, everything's going to be fairly fine. Everything will be on time and basically in one group. But when you divide that up, now you might have early and later kind of things going on. So it's kind of a catch-22 that way.
Hmm. Brad Hutnick with us, forest silviculturist at the Wisconsin DNR, as we talk about the science of leaves, how to identify a tree by its leaves, and you can join in along the way. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike in Delavan is here. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. My wife calls a buckeye tree a walnut tree, and they've really blossomed out, the walnuts, and they're got numerous small branches, I would say anywhere from an inch to 2 inch in diameter, that are hanging, almost touching the ground. and there's probably a half a dozen of them that I'd like to trim off, but I'm concerned about, you know, maybe killing the tree out and doing it during this warmer weather. Can you give me some information with that regarding that?
Sure. So we have a buckeye here in Wisconsin, which is kind of a, if you saw the leaf, it actually has something called a palmate. So each of the leaflets are coming off a center point. And then we do have walnuts, right? Black walnuts. And we even have butternut, which is related to walnut. And so, and we have lots of different nicknames for different tree species. But I think in general, this time of the year, things are starting to, as I mentioned, the senescence. So when we're probably about the middle part of the month, like right about now, most of the trees here in Wisconsin are either in the process of already shut down, meaning they're basically done growing for the year. They're basically just letting the leaves go at this point. And so you're probably not in any problems. If you had to prune them now, you're probably not going to be, you know, I don't think there would be a problem. But if it's not something you have to do right now, then it's always better to do it when you know they're completely senesced and everything else. And so I would usually, like, wintertime is a great time to do something like that.
Mike, thanks. Let's go to Sherry in Superior with a question. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
What would you like to ask?
I have a question about a tree that got stressed over the winter. It was one of those that was bent over with all the snow. It's very large. It's like a 25-foot tree, deciduous tree. I don't know. I call it a larch, but the leaves have been dying slowly all summer, and I'm just wondering how long you should let something like that go. Should we give it another season to see if it comes around, or is the thing dying?
Thank you, Sherry. Yes, Brad, about a minute here.
Yeah, so basically it depends on your time frame, right? Like if you want to see something else in there real quick, or you can tolerate looking at it that way, that's fine. But I would, if it were me and if it weren't in an area that was highly visible, I'd give it a little more time.
Should people rake fallen leaves or leave them alone?
It depends. Leaves are fantastic in a forested situation. So that's basically, one of the pumps that keeps a forest moving, the nutrients in those leaves. In a yard, you might want to mulch them up and spread them just so they don't kill out grass. But I think they can be really useful in your yard as well.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
Brad Hutnick is a forest silviculturist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, working to manage healthy forests. And if you would like to, if you've missed any part of our conversation, you can always stream or download a recording later today. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.